Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Edmund White, whose latest book is My Lives, an Autobiography, the most recent novel, Fanny, several other books, essays. Edmund White teaches at Princeton University, a colleague of Joyce Carol Oates.
Right.
What prompted you to write your memoir autobiography at this time?
I think if you wait too long, you forget everything, and you lose touch with your earlier life. And I'm 66 years old, so I thought, well, this is the time to do it. Because I have had friends who waited too long. I mean, like Paul Bowles, for instance, I think waited too long, and his book ended up being sort of a bore. I think the real problems with memoirs are if people are too old to remember things or too discreet. You want somebody who's indiscreet.
But you can't be too indiscreet because you might really anger your friends.
Well, I've done that all my life, so I'm used to that. The friends I have left are very hardy ones.
This book is organized a little differently than most memoirs or autobiographies, which tend to start with the grandparents, move to the parents, move to growing up, and slowly you start getting to the good stuff. And you structured it differently. Was that partly the reason just to get into it, or why?
Yes, the way I structured it was by topics. So, like, the first chapter is called My Shrinks, and then I do My Mother, My Father, you know, My Blondes, My Women, My, I don't know, things like that. Yeah, partly because I had written three autobiographical novels, which are novels, and they don't claim to be the truth. I made composites, and I also simplified the chronology. I mean, if there were three guys in my life at that time, I'd make it one or something, you know. But since A Boy's Own Story, Beautiful Room is Empty, and The Farewell Symphony, since those three novels actually followed a chronological arc, started in the 50s and ended in the early 90s, I felt like I'd sort of done that. And I also, at this point in my life, very bored by childhood, especially my own. I mean, it was wonderful subject matter for me when I was 40, but when you're in your 60s, it becomes sort of a tedious thing to think about. So I thought it would be a way of writing a very fresh and entirely different book to just slice into the subject matter with these topical themes.
Were you intimidated at all by the fact that there already is a biography out there of you?
There are two, because my nephew wrote one called Original Youth, which was published by Green Candy Press, I think, which is out here in San Francisco. And that was about my first 16 years, and it's meant to be the real story of my childhood as opposed to the one I give in A Boy's Own Story. And then there's another one by Stephen Barber. No, I feel like I've had such a full life. I've known so many people. I've traveled so much. I've met everybody, I've done everything, that I feel like I could write another book like My Lives without repeating myself in any way.
I actually came up with the topics that I would have liked to have seen.
Oh, sure,
I
mean, tell me.
My partners and boyfriends.
Yeah, I left that out.
My writing outside of Janae.
Mm-hmm.
More specifically my novels.
Yeah.
My nonfiction.
Oh, my journalistic career.
Journalistic work, and
essays, too.
And the last one, which ties in with your last chapter, My Friends, I would call My Adventures, because it struck me at the end that we'd gotten all this material about the private life of Edmund White. Then at the end, you give us tantalizing 20 pages about things you've done and the people you've done them with. And I went, holy cow, that's the book.
Well, that could be another book. Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, for instance, I include a picture of Truman Capote and me, but I don't really talk about him at all. You know, that was a picture that was taken by Robert Mapplethorpe, so that was interesting. I mean, I have known a lot of people. But the funny thing is, I just mentioned in one paragraph all the people I could have written about, but that I didn't, and I was accused of name-dropping. I can't tell you how many reviews have said White is an inveterate name-dropper. Well, actually, there's almost no name-dropping in this book. And for somebody who's known everybody from... I've known everybody from the Queen of Sweden to the Queen of England. You could write about all that stuff,
right?
But I didn't. I mean, I wanted to write about things that were personal. Anyway, yeah, I could write another whole book. Maybe I will.
Let's talk a little about some of the elements in the book. The one chapter that struck me is too much, way too much information. You can tell me the name of it. You know which one it is.
My Master.
Yeah. It struck me, maybe I'm wrong, that the reason it's there, one of the reasons, is because when you were working on your book, that was the obsession that was in your mind.
Right.
Is that correct?
Well, that's right. That's fair enough, I think. I mean, in other words, it's like one time I was giving a series of readings in Germany in English, and there was a teenage boy in the front row in Munich who was bright red in the face with absolute rage against me the whole time. And finally he said, "Well, you write about all these things that happened to you 40 years ago, and you're totally smug about them. Why don't you give us any battle reports from your current life? What about some angst literature?" So I thought, well, he's perfectly right. So that encouraged me to write this chapter. It doesn't fit with the others, but then again, the form is set up so that things don't have to be continuous and smooth. If my writing has one problem, one big problem, it's smoothness. I mean, it's so smooth that sometimes the mind slips right off it. But not this chapter.
This chapter concerns your relationship, more an obsession than a relationship, between you and a young man, while your partner is watching.
Well, he's
from
not
the
literally watching.
No, from the sidelines. Uh-huh. Poor guy.
Oh, I mean, people say that all the time in reviews, like, poor guy. And not only poor guy for that, but somebody who absolutely hates my writing, who reviewed this book in The Australian, which is Murdoch's paper, said the poor partner, Michael, has to also listen to all this prose. He deserves a purple heart. No, I mean, the truth is that I think a lot of gay men have the kind of relationship Michael and I have, but almost nobody ever writes about it or talks about it, which is where we've been together 11 years. He's 25 years younger than I am. We get along fabulously well. We really love each other. It's a totally supportive and sweet relationship. Maybe the first 2 years we were together, we had some quarrels. Now we never do. We really esteem one another and try to make the other one happy. Michael was very, 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 very sympathetic in my torment over this guy. I mean, I suppose if he had been free and wanted to move in with us, that might have been a sticking point. I don't put myself in a very good light at any point. I'm trying to tell the truth rather than to do a publicity routine.
And how does Michael feel now when he looks at the book?
He hasn't reread it. I mean, he read it when I finished it, because he always helps me with my writing.
Well, he's a writer, right?
He's a writer. He liked it at the time and thought it was good. He was the one who urged me to write the Genet chapter because he said, otherwise there's nothing in it about your writing. And I felt that, oh, God, that's so boring, you know. But he said, no, that'll be one of the most interesting chapters. And it turns out a lot of people agree with him.
I think partly because it mixes the personal with the world, which you do also in your chapter on Michel Foucault. He's the only major celebrity, in quotes, who winds up in this book.
Yeah, because he really was a friend, so, you know, I figure, well, I'm not going to keep him out just because he's famous.
Do you ever think back on relating the early life of Edmund White sitting in Cincinnati with a strange mother and an absent father with the later life hobnobbing with the celebrities living on the Île Saint-Louis and try to just put those pieces together and think, my God, look how far I've come.
Well, you know, I think that's something that Americans do. Because my mother, for instance, never wore shoes till she was 16, lived in a little shack next to the railroad tracks where her father was a railroad Johnny in Texas at the beginning of the 20th century. And she ended up on the 58th floor of a skyscraper looking out over Lake Michigan and the director of a medical clinic. So she had quite a trajectory. I feel I have had too. But I think that's the wonderful thing about America, that lives can change that way. I mean, I've been in group therapy with guys who seemed almost interchangeable with me. And then once you start digging, one is from a little farm in Puerto Rico and another one from a rich family in Kalamazoo. And, you know, and you hear these entirely different strange lives, but the strangeness of the people around us is oftentimes masked by a kind of uniform, jokey, kind of low-key American casual manner. I think that there's a dangerous aspect to what I'm talking about, which suggests that there really is a lot of social mobility in America, and I don't think there is. But there's some social mobility, probably more than you would find in England or France, for instance, two countries I know well.
But the social mobility that you're talking about comes in through the arts, let's say. It doesn't come in through
making money.
Making money,
no,
that's for sure.
Yeah.
At what point did do you think the transit from Edmund White, struggling unknown, to the later part of your life? At what point did that happen? Was it after the publication of the first book?
Boys on Story?
Boys on Story?
I remember when that came out, Susan Sontag said to me, "You'll never have to go without a meal again. You know, you're okay now." And it was sort of true. I mean, and there have been months when I couldn't pay the rent. But still, basically, it did put me on the map in a way that I was able to benefit from as a journalist, and then eventually as a teacher of creative writing.
And by that time, you already knew Susan Sontag, though.
That's true. But I was working for $20,000 a year running in 1981, running the New York Institute for the Humanities. I mean, it's true that I had very exalted positions even kind of early on. I taught at Yale in 1975. My first novel, Forgetting Elena, was praised by Nabokov, you know. So, I mean, I had a lot of breaks, but none of them actually helped me to pay the rent. And to this day, I'm still broke in the way that most literary artists are, I guess.
For you as a well-known writer, what percentage of your income actually comes from your writing?
About 30% or 40%, yeah.
Have any of your books been turned into films?
No.
Any interest in any of that, do you think?
One was The Married Man, is a novel I wrote that takes place in France. It has been optioned by a French producer who wants to make a French movie out of it. That just happened recently. I wonder if it'll happen. I mean, I've had those things happen before. Two or three times I've had books optioned. I don't think my books, when people read them, I don't think they immediately think, oh, this would make a great movie.
Your chapters on your father and mother are fairly straightforward. You have a sister, but you didn't seem to have much of a relationship with her.
Well, I haven't written about her yet. I mean, I would love to write about her. She's a totally fascinating person. But, of course, you can only write so much in any one book. And I will write about her at some point. She's gay, kind of non-practicing lesbian. But she has adopted, well, she had three children of her own, and now she's adopted another eight who are all children of color. They're either Asian or black. And they all were born as HIV babies. And she's 70 years old and has some in diapers. So, I mean, she's pretty amazing. She's setting up a clinic in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. She's very adventurous and creative and, I think, in some ways almost saintly. She's a great person.
It would appear then, even though on some level you denigrate your father as being the most boring man on the planet and your mother as being pretty nuts, that the two of you came through it with flying colors, and you really have to attribute quite a bit of it to your upbringing then.
I don't know. I mean, maybe, yes, but I don't know. It seemed to me like I had 25 years of psychoanalysis. I'm somebody who's never stopped learning and reading. But on the other hand, I've known people who had similar parents who became totally psychotic and could never leave the house. I don't know. I mean, how much should be attributed to one's own will toward health, toward happiness, and how much should be attributed to parents? I mean, if by definition you think the way people turned out is due to their childhood, then yes, of course, it's a tautology. But if you accept the idea that there are lots of different possible fates that could be dealt out to somebody given the same childhood, then I would take credit for some of the good things that happened to me. I would also attribute some of it to homosexuality, because I think that the fact that my sister and I are both gay, in a way, took us out of the normal trajectory for people like us, which would have been, I think, rather gloomy.
When you've got something which sets you apart, it forces you to question all of your values and all of the values that have been inculcated in you. In your case, when you open up the book with My Shrinks, we see how, in many respects, everyone tried to push you back in that box.
Yeah, I mean, I myself collaborated in a half-hearted way with the project of trying to turn myself straight for 25 years. And it was a terrible waste of time, but that's what people did in the 50s and 60s. Everything up to Stonewall, I mean, gays were filled with self-hate. And to the degree that they were intelligent, they were all the better in prosecuting themselves.
Question then about Stonewall. You don't deal with your reaction to the transition of gay life as it made its way consciously into American society. Do you recall any signposts for you along the way, those aha moments?
Well, I mean, I was in the Stonewall Uprising, and then when it was over, I moved to Rome. That was in June, and then by the following January, I'd moved to Rome. And when I came back a year later, everything had changed in New York. There were now huge discos, gay discos, and endless backroom bars where there had been nothing like that before. I remember a friend of mine picking me up at the airport and popping some acid in my mouth and taking me off to this incredible farrago that New York had become. So that was a big aha moment. I mean, the idea that you could go from just a handful of persecuted gay bars where nobody felt very comfortable and people wouldn't even acknowledge each other later on the street to these mammoth sound factories, the discos of the era, and all these back rooms and then all the kind of free for all sex along the waterfront at night. All that was the 70s, and the 70s came in with a roar. And then there were other things like the birth of the Gay Academic Union. I remember that in the early 70s, you know, where groups of scholars who were at universities wanted to be able to write about gay life in an open way and to even have it be a course at the universities. All that would have did seem preposterous to somebody of my generation, but also wonderfully welcome. So it was a very sudden transition, especially for me because I was away for a year. And I was in Rome at a time when Italy was still very repressive toward homosexuality. And I, being such a chameleon, I immediately adapted myself to that kind of closetedness in Rome. And then when I came back, oh, it was a free-for-all. So it was very dramatic for me.
You're listening to an interview with Edmund White, whose book is titled My Lives, an Autobiography. When you moved to Paris, back to Paris, of course, Paris had changed also at that point, which meant that the change in America seemed to have affected the change in Europe.
Paris went through a kind of very interesting change of its own, which is that they elected François Mitterrand. And Mitterrand was elected in 81, and I happened to be in Paris when he was elected. And that was a moment of total joy for everybody on the left, including gays. And instantly, the new French socialist government decided to take off the books all laws against homosexuality, to release the handful of people who were in prison for gay crimes, and to stop policing the parks and the saunas and so on, and the bars, and just let everybody go and do whatever they wanted to do. And that stayed that way. So that was an amazing breath of fresh air. Later, people came to see that there were problems with Mitterrand and matters of corruption and collaboration that weren't too pleasant. But it was the same kind of exhilaration I think Americans felt when Kennedy was elected. And there turned out to be problems with Kennedy, too. But still, for a brief moment, it seemed like the dawning of a golden age.
Kennedy seemed like the dawning of a golden age, but America changed between 68 and 70. I mean, it changed later on. In this case, it did change under the early days of Mitterrand.
Yeah. No, it did absolutely change. And that was important and good. You know, almost any moment in history has its downside. The downside in the case of all this suddenly licensed promiscuity in France was that that was also the beginning of AIDS. And so it meant that the rate of AIDS infection in France was twice as high as it was in England, a country of exactly the same size.
You spend a lot of time talking about some of your friends, including Foucault, who you also knew over here, and Gilles Barbedette,
mm-hmm.
who may have been your best friend over there, would you say?
My best friend was this woman, Marie-Claude de Bronhoff, but he was one of my closest friends. He was my translator for a while. In my early days in Paris, I couldn't speak French, and he would go with me to interviews that I would have to do to make a living for Vogue. My very first interview was of Eric Rohmer, the filmmaker, who's one of the most erudite and brilliant people in France. And, of course, I had no idea what he was saying. I knew enough French to be able to articulate my questions, but I couldn't do any follow-up because I couldn't figure out what the hell he was saying. But Gilles was there, and I recorded it all, and he played, and we went through it all. So it was a very funny kind of collaboration.
It was also funny reading that because you describe Rohmer as a very old man, you know, doddering, and he's still making movies.
He must be in his 90s, though, now. Yeah. And he was this kind of brilliant intellectual who only was fascinated with shop girls, and all his movies are about that.
Your chapter on Genet is, for me, fascinating, partly because it reveals you as a writer and your method of research. And I'm curious about the relationship between the research you did for Genet, granted he was contemporary so you could talk to the people who knew him, and the research you did for your historical fiction, Fanny. Was it a completely different process or a similar process?
Different, because with Genet, I felt this great weight of responsibility. I felt like I'm writing the first biography of him, and I'm interviewing people who are still alive, and if I don't get it right, nobody will get to these people before they die, because a lot of them were quite elderly, and many of them have since died. Plus, I was writing about one of France's greatest writers while living in France, so I was very aware of my target audience being the French as well as Americans and English people.
And you knew it was going to be translated.
It was almost simultaneously translated. Okay. So it came out at the same time in both countries. Whereas Fanny is a novel, and it's an invention. That is, Fanny is a book supposedly written by Frances Trollope, the mother of the great prolific novelist Trollope, and it's about Frances Wright, who's this fantastically interesting figure in American history whom almost nobody knows about, who started a utopian colony, who believed in free love, and who was one of the most important abolitionists and the first woman ever to speak in public in America to a mixed crowd. But it was a novel, and it was a totally made-up book. It's a kind of spoof or pastiche or whatever you want to call that, imitation of the style of the early 19th century. So it called upon powers of research, but also of invention and imitation. And also, I didn't feel absolutely bound to be totally accurate. So that, for instance, Frances Wright took her slaves and freed them in Haiti eventually. And Mrs. Trollope did not go along on that trip, but I have her go so that I can report what Haiti was like in the 1820s.
How did that particular decision come about?
I realized that it was like too good a story to miss. I thought this could be so interesting, because Frances Wright in real life was the first white person, man or woman, to be received officially in 25 years since the founding of the Haitian Republic. And they loved her because they knew she was a friend to African American people. So she was received in great state, and I thought that would be so interesting to describe. And if I don't have Mrs. Trollope, who's supposedly writing my book, there, how would she know about it?
That gives you a certain freedom. Yet at the same time, you also know that you have to stick within certain boundaries, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the birth dates and the death dates are the same. And a lot of the events, most of the events, parallel something that really happened. But I think no one has actually studied this book at all yet, and maybe someday somebody will. And I think when they do, they'll see how intricate it really is.
Would you call this your first absolutely non-autobiographical novel? I mean, I know Caracol is not specifically, but you talk in My Lives about the way you use people you knew in that book.
Yeah. Although even Fanny, I thought of Mrs. Trollope as being very much like my mother. I mean, somebody who always was jabbering, who had tremendous courage and was quite gallant, who had no worries about being totally inconsistent from one statement to the next, and who had very strong sexual desires. All that describes my mother as well. And so I think my mother had died by the time I began work on this book. I was sort of missing her, and I invoked her in that, only in that very remote sense that every novelist knows about, even people who write fantasy novels. It is autobiographical, but in no other sense is it.
Did you find the idea of doing that kind of book after all of the autobiography really freeing or limiting?
Yeah, tremendous relief. Yeah. But it was also a kind of new thing. Now I'm writing another novel in the same vein, which is called Hotel de Dream, and I'm almost done. And it's about Stephen Crane, who wrote Red Badge of Courage. And his wife, Cora, was a prostitute who had a house of prostitution in Jacksonville called Hotel de Dream. I'm writing about the last 2 weeks in his life and how he tries to reconstruct a book about a male prostitute, which he did, in fact, begin and which he destroyed after he wrote 40 pages of it because he thought he could never get it published and that it would hurt his career. Now I have him rewriting it. So again, it's a kind of imitation of somebody else's style. It's an insertion of myself as a witness into the mind of a straight man who dies at age 28 in 1900, and yet who has enormous sympathy for the underclass everywhere, including gay people.
It sounds to me as if you've reached a point where you can finally go, you know, Edmund White, that gay writer, been there, done that.
Well, I never made up the label, but
right,
I haven't been opposed to it. But I've written lots of things. My first novel, Forgetting Elena, is a fantasy novel that people call a gay novel, but there's almost nothing gay in it. They say it takes place on Fire Island, whereas I never thought of that. I thought of it as taking place in the magical kingdom it claims to be taking place in. But in any event, I've written lots of different kinds of books, and I want to go on doing that. My boyfriend suggested to me recently that I should just keep a journal for a year and publish that. And I've never kept a journal my whole life, and so I'm thinking that would be a good idea. I want to write a book about New York in the 1970s, a nonfiction study of the high art and the links between the world of high art and homosexuality in the 1970s with figures like Jasper John, Susan Sontag, and so on. John Ashbery. I mean, New York was kind of paradise on earth in the 70s. It was maybe the last gasp of America's interest in high culture. For instance, Brad Gooch, who's a young writer, a not-so-young writer, who looks very young, in the 70s, he had a lover called Howard Bruckner, who was already a kind of successful film director who had made a movie with Madonna and Matt Dillon. And Brad didn't dare tell us that he was a movie maker because film was so low prestige in New York in the 70s, unless it was Jonas Mekas or some kind of avant-garde filmmaking. But Hollywood was really looked down on by New Yorkers. That's almost unimaginable now. Even to the people who lived through that period, they can hardly remember that they ever thought that. And the only people who were looking at America were the French, who were making idols out of our B-movie directors.
Edmund White, when we began the interview, you talked about how some people accused you of being a name dropper. I'm all for that. Let me throw out some names. I'd like you to talk about these people because you don't talk about it in your book. But they have been one level or another, either central or just a little side trip in your own life. Truman Capote.
Well, actually, I only met him once, and I did this interview of him, and Mapplethorpe went along with me. We were both young, fairly unknown writers and photographers, and Mapplethorpe took the pictures. And I said, why are you taking a picture of me? And he said, oh, you'll be pleased that I did this years later. Anyway, Capote was completely bombed that day on cocaine and would leave the room every 2 minutes, wasn't sharing. And it was terribly hot. And anyway, I love Capote's writing, and it was a thrill to meet him that one time.
But you don't get any sense of who he was just from that brief trip.
No. I mean, I've written extensively about him as a writer.
Right.
I've written about a 40-page essay, and I do love his writing, and I've written about him several times, but as a writer.
Susan Sontag.
Well, that's a complex story. I mean, we became friends in the 70s. She helped me a lot. She got me an award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She was the one who really got me to be the head of the New York Institute for the Humanities. I got a Guggenheim. She wrote a blurb on the back of a Boys on Story. She did a lot to help me. I was extremely devoted to her. Then I moved to Paris in 83, and I wrote a novel called Caracol, in which she appears as a character, but only she would have recognized herself because I did such a good job of disguising her. I mean, basically, it's taking place in the 18th century in Venice, and the woman I base on her isn't even a writer and in no way resembles her physically. So that seems to me fair enough. It was only the relationship between her, the character, and her son that resembled, in a way, Susan's with her son. And they were both outraged. But, I mean, Susan's the kind of person, she was the kind of person that, if you said in print, Sontag knows all about Chinese restaurants, as Gary Indiana once wrote in The Village Voice, she immediately cut him off for saying that. You couldn't say anything about that would allude to your own personal relationship with her. Well, I didn't betray her in any way. I just wrote a novel in which she was totally disguised, but she saw it as a betrayal. And we had a terrible feud that went on for years. But toward the end of her life, we had a reconciliation. We met in a restaurant. We embraced. We wept. And then it didn't go anywhere. It didn't take. Like so many of those reconciliations that follow years and years of feuding. But I never really feuded with her. I always said I admired her and loved her, which I did.
Gore Vidal.
I don't know him too well. I first met him at Peggy Guggenheim's in Venice in 1973. He was very nice. I've written a play. He was a friend of Isherwood, whom I loved and knew. And he would sometimes, if he was staying with Isherwood, the two of them would call me. Then I wrote a play recently about Timothy McVeigh and Gore Vidal that's going to be done at the Edinburgh Festival this summer, which will be done here in San Francisco in a year. I talk about incidents that never really happened, like Vidal never actually met McVeigh, so I pretend that he went on the eve of McVeigh's execution and talk to him, which could have happened.
The Queen of England.
The Queen of England I only met once, and that was at a reception for her Golden Jubilee at the Royal Academy of Art. And I happened to be in London, and this is a very nice girl called Belinda Harvey, who is the secretary for the Prince of Wales. So I used to take her out. So she put my name down on the list. That's how I would think I was the only American who was there. I went with Martin Amis, and Martin was actually presented to the Queen. I wasn't. I was just milling around looking at all the other celebs. But Martin said to the Queen, "Nice to meet you, ma'am. You knighted my father, King Amis." And she said, "I have no memory of that." I guess she has to be honest. You know, she can't fake it all the time.
Edmund White, let's shift gears for a second. It is 2006. We've certainly come a long way from Stonewall in 1970. Can you put your finger on where the gay scene is now and politically where you think it is in America today?
Marriage, gay marriage is still the big issue. And originally I was sort of opposed to it because I saw it as just one more effort for the gay community to assimilate itself to an already despicable straight community. But now I'm all for it because I figure if people are so opposed to it, it must be good and it must be a good issue. And it's a good issue in the sense that it really gets people where they live. I mean, once you start involving what people imagine is the sacrament of marriage, although I'm not sure, I'm not a Christian, but I have the feeling that it's not really a sacrament. But anyway, people think it's a sacrament. And then children, I think once people get terribly conservative wherever children are involved. So having seen my own sister adopt these children who were rejected by everybody else and do such a wonderful job with them, I just think it's terrible that gay people can't get married and adopt children if they want to do that. So I'm all for that. I think that's still the biggest issue, and I think it's a very interesting issue because the problem with America is it's so religious. I mean, 40% of the American people have had a personal conversation with Jesus Christ. I mean, it's pretty weird, and that is why I think gays have such a hard time in this country because it's considered a sin and an abomination. I mean, if you compare it to other countries that you would think would be similar, like, I mean, Spain has now legalized gay marriage. And they just had a poll in Spain that showed that 60% of the Spanish voters approve of the legalization of gay marriage. I mean, can you imagine figures like that ever coming out in this country? No. And it's all due to this wonderful religion of ours.
In My Lives, you talk about psychotherapy and gays. I mean, that's obviously changed tremendously. And I think that that has probably changed the way America thinks.
Yes and no. I mean, it's true that homosexuality was declassified as a character disorder and turned into just one of the normal variations by the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatry. But now there are quite a few psychiatrists who are trying to reverse that. I mean, it's partly cha-ching that that's a source of money for them to have gays become ex-gays. But I think it's also that in the convictions of many of those ghastly old doctors that they really do think that it is a sickness, and because Freud says as much.
And American politics today?
Well, I mean, it can't get any loonier than it's gotten. I mean, it is really spun out of control, I think. And I think a lot of people have a kind of apocalyptic feeling about America right now, like that something really ghastly is going to happen. Of course, the administration feeds on that, I think, partly. All the scare now about bird flu, I think, is supposed to probably prop up his numbers. But nothing seems to work for Bush. And I think that we're watching just a total mindset and point of view wind down and go out of control. But I don't know what's going to replace it. Nobody seems to feel very enthusiastic about the Democratic Party's leadership.
We seem to be in this kind of, almost like we've jumped into a swamp. You know, you're in the swamp and you know it's a swamp and you want to get out of the swamp, but there's no tree to climb on.
That's a very good analogy.
You know,
I mean, it's hitting us on every front, economic especially, and I think everybody lives in dread of all the bills coming due in a very few years. The inability to have a national health program when every other civilized country in the world does. The fact that we still have the death penalty, and only rarely do you see something like the Massawi decision. We're right there with communist China, Iran, and two or three other, Saudi Arabia, and the number of executions we have.
When I look at all of this, and I want to point a finger, I mean, there are lots of places to point, religion, opportunists, corporations, but if I were to point a finger, I would have to point it at the mainstream media.
Well, they certainly were slow in criticizing this government. I mean, the way that they let them, the way that Guantanamo Bay just came and existed and nobody seemed to respond to that or criticize it. I guess for people of my age, I'm in my 60s, who were leftists in the 60s, the 1960s, and when a period when any tiny infraction on the part of government would bring down a howling mob on their back, the fact that all this went unnoticed, and only magazines with a circulation of 15,000 people wrote articles against it, is really shocking. I think you're right. It's the mainstream media has a lot of culpability in this matter.
There's a lot of people who will say that gay marriage is inevitable, and yet you talk about how some shrinks are trying to turn back the clock, making me think that things don't move in one direction and they're cyclic. Have we hit the height of gay acceptance, do you think, or is this permanent?
I think that it is permanent. I mean, I think the real problem in the 50s when I was growing up was that you could watch television, or if there was one, or listen to radio for 2 years without ever hearing the word homosexuality mentioned. There was really a total blackout on it. Now, whether people are for it or against it, there's all this debate. And my own feeling is that every time homosexuality is mentioned on TV, another 10 people come out. That people can now recognize the nature of their desires. And I think that's a very good thing. We'll always be a tiny part of the population. We'll never be more than 3% of the population. So we'll never have, unless we can create alliances, we'll never have any real political heft. But I do think we'll have more and more visibility and ultimately acceptance.
About 2 years ago, I interviewed Robert McNeil, and we were talking about the state of America, and he said that he feels the ship is on its side, but he said that ships tend to right themselves. And do you think that's going to happen here?
I'm not sure. I mean, it seems to me that the power of rich people in this country over politics is really appalling, and it's become more and more pronounced. I hope so. I mean, I hope that there will be a demand for better and higher ethical standards and more legal treatment of prisoners, for instance. I hope things like that will happen, and I think they will. But I think the real question is, does the average person get represented in Washington? And I think less and less, and I'm afraid that is a terrible tendency that will probably go on for quite a while.
Do you feel that you as an artist have a responsibility in that way? And some responsibility in terms of discussing issues, or no?
It's very hard to think that a writer whose books cost $25 and maybe 17,000 copies of them are sold has much responsibility in a really practical sense for diffusing ideas. If you want to diffuse ideas, there are a lot of better methods, like the radio, television, and other fora. I feel that an artist should remain true to his own vision, and that wherever it takes him. And I know that's a very romantic notion. I don't feel too much of a sense of political responsibility. And what's interesting is that in terms of gay life, in the early days of, let's say, 1970, I would have felt maybe more responsibility because there were so few visible gays. Now there are a lot of politicians, a lot of movie stars, a lot of television and radio personalities who are out. So I think they've sort of taken up the slack. But writers did have a peculiar weight put on their shoulders in the early 70s. And I think it's always that way with the beginning of a minority. When a minority first begins to have a voice, is that the writers are oftentimes required to speak forth. I remember when the Iron Curtain came down, Newsweek called me and said, "Well, what do you think of all this?" And I said, "Now their writers will be as unimportant as ours."
Edmund White, you've come out with My Lives. You're working on this historical novel about Stephen Crane. You've got a play about Gore Vidal. You're starting, perhaps, a daily journal. And are you thinking about the second volume of memoirs, too?
Well, why not? I think so. Yeah, I mean, maybe down the road a ways. Because I do think I could write, you know, another one just the same length and maybe just as interesting, maybe slightly more serious. This one maybe goes into sex too much for most people's taste. Although I find sex, not pornography, but the realistic account of sex as one of the most interesting topics.
You've been listening to an interview with Edmund White, whose latest book is My Lives, an Autobiography. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.